Welcome back to the Tanakh Study Center series on Nevi'im Rishonim. In today's shiur, we're going to continue our study of Sefer Melachim Aleph and focus on chapters 14 through 19, and primarily on the entry of Eliyahu into the stories of Sefer Melachim. As we all know, Eliyahu, or Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu Navi, is a very prominent figure in Judaism, and the primary stories to talk about Eliyahu and all the things that he did begin in chapters 16, 17, and 18 in Sefer Melachim. In today's shiur, we're going to try to understand what's the background that brings Eliyahu into the picture. Because Sefer Melachim, we would expect, would focus on the story of the kings of Israel, the monarchies who reigned and the split in the kingdom. But for some reason, two prophets, Eliyahu and later Elisha, are going to get a lot of press. There'll be a lot of discussion about them in Sefer Melachim. And the goal of today's shiur is to try to understand why is it that Eliyahu enters the picture and does so many things which are so strange and not regular for a Navi. To appreciate the setting when he enters, we have to dedicate several minutes to follow what's been happening to the monarchy. Recall from our last year, there was a split in the monarchy during the time of Rechavam, the son of Shlomo. Shlomo had achieved tremendous prosperity. He made a name for God. Things were going so great, so successful. And there was a fall of that prosperity. The grandeur of the time of Shlomo, when Israel had become a superpower, was known internationally. They had made a name for themselves and for God. That greatness fell apart over the span of about 10-20 years. What was the reason for that fall? The Navi in Sefer Melachim tries to explain the reason for that fall was because of the sins of Shlomo following his other two. He took too many wives. They were a bad influence on him. And we discussed that in our last year. We also explained the political reason for that fall, the unrest by the people of the northern kingdoms because of the very difficult taxation that all this growth had put on them. And we saw how the revolt of Yerovam in many ways was a workers' revolt against many mean and oppressive leaders. We even saw how Yerovam's revolt was initiated by a Navi, by a prophet, by Achiah Shiloni, and God had high expectations for Yerovam. What Sefer Melachim is going to explain is why was it that Shlomo lost his kingdom? Why is it that that prosperity fell apart? We have a prophetic reason, even though for sure there was also a political reason, and that, as usual, the point of the Navi is to find the deeper reason behind the development of the events. But in our study, if we don't notice the political reasons, we won't appreciate the point that the Navi is trying to make. In a similar way, there's going to be very good reason why Yerovam's original attempt to take over the kingdom and make life better for the people up north, there's going to be a very good political reason for why that falls apart. There'll also be a prophetic reason. The Navi is going to blame this on the institution of the Bamot, of the high places of worship in Beit El and Dan. Now recall, Yerovam at least claimed to be doing this for religious reasons. The claim of the people was that this was the proper way to worship God. But it was this institution of religious reform for the sake of political gain that got God so angry that caused Yerovam to lose his kingdom. And God was hoping that Baasha would do something better. And Baasha, even though he fulfilled his charge to destroy the house of Yerovam, he himself didn't continue in a proper way. He's also going to be punished. But we're also going to see there's a very logical political reason for the fall of Yerovam's kingdom and later of that of Baasha. And that's going to be the civil war that takes place between Yehuda and Israel. In Sefer Melachim, we talk about a certain tension between the northern kingdom and Yehuda, but there's the story of a terrible civil war that's only recorded in Divrei Yamim Bet, in the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 13, in Perek Yud Gimel. There's a story about a war that takes place between Abiyah, the son of Rehavam, who was only king for a few years, and Yerovam in the last year or two of his kingdom. There was a terrible civil war that takes place with over 500,000 casualties. It's devastating to the people of Israel. And even though Yerovam had promised so much improvement for his people, for his workers, it turns out that despite all of his promises, it was his greed and his attempt to take over Yehuda that was going to bring his downfall. And that civil war, and not only the civil war, not only all the loss of life, but also how that civil war destroyed the economy of Israel, is going to bring down Yerovam's kingdom and lead to a coup d'etat by Baasha. Baasha is going to be, again, another popular leader who's going to take over the country because the people were very distraught and very upset with what Yerovam had done. The other political reason for the fall of Israel's prosperity is because of their inability to control the main highway. Once the tribes split and they no longer can pull the resources together, and now that they're fighting with one another, right away Egypt, Sheshach, the king of Egypt, comes and takes over the Via Maris, the main highway between Israel and Mesopotamia. And we no longer control the coastal road. And therefore, we can't tax that coastal road. And therefore, instead of becoming a superpower, again, we become a second or third rate nation in the Middle East. And during all these years, Israel begins to fall apart. Nothing is going well at all for the northern kingdoms. All the promise of reform gets them nowhere. Bashar is no better than Yerovam. And there's another coup d'etat against him with Zimri, and then Zimri, and then later Omri. It seems to be year after year, every couple decades or so, there's another coup d'etat. Despite all the promise of the reform that Yerovam tried to institute, and all the anger of the northern tribes against Yehuda, things did not get any better. Down south in Yehuda, Shishak, the king of Egypt, came and almost destroyed all of Yehuda. Yerushalayim was saved finally at the last minute. Rehoboam was able to reestablish his kingdom, and later Abiya had a couple military successes. Asa had some good years and some bad years. And finally we get to Yehoshaphat, who's able to put the country of Yehuda back on its feet. And at the same time, we have a new king in Israel up north, Omri, one of the generals who finally was able to take over Zimri and establish his kingdom. And later he has a son, Ahav. And for the first time since the split in the kingdom, under the rules of Yehoshaphat in the south and the reign of Ahav, the son of Omri, in the north, we finally have a situation where Israel's back on its feet, and there's a very logical political reason for this. That's because Yehoshaphat and Ahav decide to work together. After so many decades of a split monarchy, they're so far apart that they're able to become friends again. The tensions and all the civil war from the time of Abiya and Yerovam and from the time of Asa and Baasha, all those years of strife and civil war, the people finally got over that. And the new kings, both of Yehuda and of Israel, decide to change policy, and instead of fighting with each other, they decide to work together. It's going to be that background that will help us understand why Eliyahu enters the picture and why he does what he does. Let's try to understand what was the policy of Ahav. Ahav was the son of Omri. Omri made a very wise political move. He decided that in order for the 10 tribes to become politically sound and to develop the economy and to become a superpower once again, Omri decided to change policy, and he enters into an agreement, into a treaty with the city of Sidon, what we would call nowadays Lebanon. Sidon is the main port city of the area north of Israel, which we call today Lebanon. And that was a very strong and powerful port city at that time. And it's politically wise both for the king of Sidon and for Ahav, first Omri and later Ahav, to make a treaty with one another. And to solidify that treaty, the son of Omri, Ahav, marries the daughter of the king of Sidon, and her name is Izebel. The background for that political alliance is the prospect of a flourishing economy if these two countries are able to work together. And that becomes the decision of the northern tribes to enter a political treaty with Sidon, which is reflected by the entry of Izebel into Israeli politics. But there's a price the Jewish people have to pay for Izebel. When Izebel comes and wants the northern tribes in Israel to become part of the new Middle East, she brings with her her culture. The Navi describes when Izebel comes and Ahav marries Izebel, she comes with 400 Nevi'i Baal, 400 prophets of the Baal, and 450 prophets of Asherah. Who is this Asherah and Baal? We're going to see how the Navi, how the prophets are going to be so angry at Ahav for his allowing Asherah and Baal, these two gods, to become so popular. But there's a way of understanding why they do become so popular. Asherah and Baal are gods, or Canaanite gods, well known to anyone who studies the history of the ancient Near East. Baal is a rain god. Asherah is a fertility god. Now, people living in our area, in the land of Israel, need rain for survival. Without rain, nothing will grow. Anyone who reads Shema every day, the second parsha of Shema, Ba'in Shema, talks about how important it is, our need for matar, for rain to come at the right time. We, the Jewish people, attribute the rain coming to the God of Israel, to the one God, the God of all mankind. And we claim that the amount of rain that we get will be a function of our deeds and our dedication to God. The people in the Middle East had a different explanation for the rain. There was a rain god, one god that took care of rain, and that was it. And if people wanted rain, there were certain rituals that people had to do to make sure it would rain. And there was also fertility gods, one of them being Asherah. The Baal, like the husband, the rain, would inseminate the ground. And Asherah, the female god, would bring produce, would bring prosperity, would allow all the crops to grow. And there were all these rituals and ways of life and culture that were done to make sure that the economy would prosper. Now, my assumption is that the people of Israel were not deep philosophers in the theory of Baal and Asherah. It was simply common culture and practice. That's the way things were done in the Middle East. And if the price of making this treaty with Sidon With the price of having Yizevel as our biggest ally, and the improvement of our economy meant that we had to put up with these 450 missionaries of Asherah and 400 of Baal, if that's the price we have to pay, it's worth it. The people who were against this were obviously Nevi Hashem. There's prophets of God up north. Recall, even though there's a split in the kingdom, and even though most of the religious people and the worship of God in the Mikdash in Yerushalayim and the tribe of Levi is now moved to Yerushalayim, Divrei HaYamim also talks about how after the split in the kingdom, the tribe of Levi was abandoned by Yerovam because he allowed anyone who wanted to become a Kohen and work in the Bamot up north. So they did abandon him, but there were still Nevi Hashem, the prophets of God, who remained up north trying to get the Jewish people to worship God properly. These Nevi'im, who Eliyahu is going to be one of their leaders, in fact, Eliyahu will be their primary leader, these Nevi'im are going to be prosecuted by Yizevel because these Nevi'im are fighting the Nevi'im, the prophets of Asherah and Baal. In other words, the culture that Yizevel is trying to bring into the country in order to make Israel and Ahav part of this new Middle East is being fought by these prophets, these Nevi'ei Hashem, who are trying to explain to the people of Israel not to accept Yizevel and all the influence that she's bringing in. It's not worth the price that we're paying for it. What does Yizevel do? We hear about that. Yizevel tries to wipe out and kill all the Nevi'ei Hashem. We hear a story later on about Ovadia. Ovadia seems to be like the Minister of Interior, a very prominent leader of the Jewish people, right-hand man to Ahav. And we see Ovadia had a lot of sympathy for these people because he was Jewish and he did appreciate them. And he hid 50 in one cave, he hid 50 in another place. Later when he meets Eliyahu, he tells Eliyahu, look at all the things I've done to save your Nevi'im. But between the lines of this story, we see a tremendous tension between Nevi Hashem, who Eliyahu is their leader, and the Nevi'im of Asherah and Baal, who brought him by Yizevel. Ahav, because he cares about the economy of Israel, he cares about the prosperity of his people. Chazal called him Ohev Yisrael, he loved Israel. He was doing what was good for Israel. He thought it was worth the price to pay to accept Yizevel and her culture if it meant Israel's back on the map again. Another political move that Ahab does is he makes a treaty with the king of Israel, with Yehoshaphat. And that's why Yehoshaphat, the king of Israel, marries Ataliah, the daughter of Ahab. Again, we see marriage as a reflection of a political treaty. And now for the first time, since the time of Shlomo, since the time of the split of the kingdom, Israel and Yehuda are working together. Now, they're so far apart culturally and religiously that they don't serve in the same temple anymore. But they're the same people. They're basically the same religion. And now we finally go to war together. Ahav and Yehoshaphat have a treaty. We find them fighting wars together against Aram. For the first time since Shlomo, the country reaches tremendous prosperity. It's never been so good. The situation that arises now is very interesting. Because now we have the people of Israel in a rather powerful position. The Middle East now is growing. They're now, once again, a superpower in the Middle East. But the only problem is they're not religious. Yehoshaphat follows God. But Ahav doesn't follow God at all. And not only are they worshiping God in Bamot and Beit El and Dan, the Nevi'im were not so happy about that. But you can compare that to the unhappiness of certain parts of ultra-Orthodoxy to other types of Orthodoxy or Reform or Conservative. I'm not going to go and take a political stand on any of these ideas. But just like nowadays, there's certain groups within Judaism who don't accept other groups for religious reasons, but they're all still part of the same religion. Here also, there's an argument whether where should God be worshipped? In Jerusalem and his temple there, or can he be worshipped in the Bamot in Beit El and Dan? That's a legitimate argument. But there's a big difference between the argument between whether Bamot, high places to worship God, were permitted, as opposed to the entry of a house for Baal and Asherah into Shomron. When Ahav allows Yizevel to establish a house for Baal and a house for Asherah in its capital city, that already has gone one step too far. That's not a different type of Judaism. That's already a totally different religion. And that's why the Navi explains why Ahav is worse than anyone before him, Omri and Ahav, by bringing Beit HaBaal into the city of Shomron, into his capital city. That's already a move that God will not be able to forgive. It is exactly at this point when Eliel comes in and says, I'm going to stop the rain. Recall chapter 17. In Perek Yitzayin, how it begins, Eliel comes and says, Chai Hashem, he swears, there won't be Tal HaMatar for the next 3 years. What's Eliel doing? Why is he stopping the rain? Eliyahu has a very simple goal. Eliyahu sees the situation as follows. Here I have, for the first time, both the tribes of Judah and Israel working together. I have a chance to bring Israel back to the situation they were in the time of Shlomo. There's only one problem, and that is Yizevel. If I could only get rid of Yizevel, if I could only get rid of these Nevi'ei Baal and Asherah, If I could only convince the people not to follow them and do something to stop this treaty between Ahav and Izebel, and instead just focus on the treaty between Yehoshaphat and Ahav and bring the God of Israel back to the Jewish people, I have a chance to bring the Jewish people back to the way they were in the time and during the good years of Shlomo. The only thing he needs to do is to prove to the people of Israel that worshipping the Baal is not getting them anywhere. The problem is that during all these years, the economy is doing great, the rain has been tremendous, and the reason that the people attribute this success to is the worship of the Baal. If again, Asherah and Baal are gods of prosperity, of rain and fertility, and the economy is doing good, they attribute this growth to the gods that they're worshipping. So it's only more reason to continue this treaty with Sidon and continue this cultural practice of serving Asherah and Baal. And that's what these prophets, these 400 prophets of Asherah and another 450 of Baal, or Baal and Asherah, that's what they're coming to explain to the people. And that's what Eliel comes to fight. How does he fight it? He makes this famous statement, I'm going to stop the rain. I'm going to stop all rain for the next 3 years to prove to the people that the rain is coming from the God of Israel and not from Baal and not from Asherah. Now, that's a very difficult gzera, that's a very difficult decree to put on the people. He's going to take an economy that's flourishing and put it into recession. And the people were very angry at Eliel. Now, everyone knows Eliel is a prophet of God, and everyone knows that he has tremendous powers. And there's going to be a tremendous argument between Ahav and Eliel. Who is Ocher Yisrael? Who is the wicked person? Who is the person ruining the country? Ahav sees Eliel as a rabbinic figure. In many ways, he might even respect him, but he sees him as the biggest danger to the Jewish people because he cursed the sky, he cursed the rain. They believe that Eliyahu has powers, but that's exactly the problem. He's using his powers to bring down his own people. They see Eliyahu as a rabbi with magic powers who can stop the rain. This background will help us explain why is it that Eliyahu enters when he does. Eliyahu finds a situation where the people of Israel are now prospering once again for the first time since Shlomo. But there's reason for their prosperity. It's because of this treaty between Sidon, between Izebel and Ahav. Eliyahu claims that he can provide the rain. He can provide the prosperity. All the Jewish people need to do is get rid of their service of the Baal. Get rid of Izebel, get rid of Baal and Asherah, and God will provide them with everything that Sidon was able to provide them with. And that's going to be the showdown that's going to take us to Har Carmel. To review that main point, what we're trying to claim is as follows. That the reason why Eliyahu enters the scene at this time, because on the one hand, there's a tremendous potential to bring the Jewish people back to God, to make the Jewish people a nation representing God once again, because there's no longer a split between the northern kings and Yehuda, because now Yehoshaphat and Ahav are working together, and once again the country is prosperous. If we were only a country following God, worshipping Him properly in the Beit HaMikdash, not having this idol worship, getting rid of Baal Asherah, we could finally be a nation representing God once again. The only thing that needs to be done to achieve this goal is to convince the people to abandon their cultural attachment to Baal and Asherah. The people don't buy it. The people are so thankful to Baal and Asherah and to Izebel for their prosperity, they're not willing to abandon them. And therefore, Eliyahu says, I'm going to prove to the people I'm going to stop the rain. After years of stopping the rain, he goes and announces to Ahav, I'm going to bring the rain back. And therefore, he gathers the entire nation to Har Carmel, and the famous story, which is the Haftarah, which we know from chapter 18 in Sefer Melachim. That's going to be the showdown where Eliyahu is hoping, I can prove to the people, Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem is the God of Israel, and there's no reason in serving the Baal. But before that happens, there's something very interesting in chapter 17. Because in many ways, Eliyahu, despite his great intentions, from an educational point of view, ends up as a failure. And there's something that's happening in chapter 17 before these events, where God tells Eliyahu, first to go hide, first he has to hide away from Ahab who's trying to chase him. And first he hides in a nachal where he's going to get water and food in a rather miraculous way. But then afterwards, when there's no more food and water where he's hiding in Nachal Crete, God sends him to Tzidon, to Nishat Tzidonit. And notice in chapter 17 that before we have the showdown between Ahab and Eliyahu, between the Nevi of Hashem and Nevi Asherah, the first thing is God is trying to show Eliyahu sometimes there's a need to go to an Isha Tzidonit from a woman from Tzidon to survive. We're not saying that Ahav was doing the right thing, but on the other hand, God might be showing Eliyahu, you have to appreciate when people do things that are wrong, sometimes the motivation isn't necessarily so evil. Sometimes you can understand their motivation, and how you treat them educationally may change depending on the motivation for their sin. Finally, in chapter 18, we have this big showdown. And what are we hoping for? What's Eliel hoping for? Eliel is hoping that when everyone witnesses that God answers the prayers of Eliel, fire comes down and accepts his korban, and a short time later, the rains begin to come. Eliel is able to prove to everyone that it's the God of Israel who controls the rain. Eliel is hoping that the people will simply get rid of Yezebel, they'll abandon the Baal, they'll cut off their ties with Sidon, and they'll follow just the God of Israel. Unfortunately for Eliel, it simply doesn't work. In chapter 19, we hear that right after all these events, Yezebel makes a statement, the same thing that Eliel did to Nevi'ah Baal, the same thing she's going to do to him. Now, how could that be? Why don't the people accept Eliel? The problem is, the people are convinced, not that the God of Israel is the only God of all mankind. The people are convinced that Eliel has superpowers. And I want you to appreciate this situation from in the eyes of the people and the eyes of prophecy. The problem in the time of the First Temple period is not whether people believe in God or don't believe in God. That's our situation today. People, either you believe in God or you don't believe in God. Back then, everyone believed in gods. Small g. There were lots of gods. The question was, are there many gods or is only one God? Eliel, according to everyone, has tremendous powers. Everyone knows that. And there is a God of Israel, but there's also Baal and Asherah. And the educational challenge that Eliel has is not to convince the Jewish people that the God of Israel exists, not to convince people that he has superpowers. His goal is to convince the people that he's the only God. He's able to convince them that he has these magic powers, that he can stop the rain and he can bring the rain. But the people think that Eliel is doing this for his own gain, that he has a personal vendetta against Yezebel, etc. And the people are not willing to abandon Yezebel and accept Eliel because they think that Eliel, even though he was able to stop the rain and bring the rain, they see Eliel as the enemy of Israel. And therefore, when Yezebel says, tomorrow, you're going to be like one of them, Yezebel puts out a warrant for his arrest. And the people accept that. Eliel sees that educationally that he's failed. Therefore, Eliel runs away in fear of his life. He runs back from Israel. He goes to Mount Sinai in a rather parallel version of what happened in Mount Sinai. Here's 40 days and 40 nights before Mount Sinai. Here, instead of Mount Sinai being thunder and lightning and fire and noise, now it's a cold mamadaka. Now things are very quiet. But when God sees Eliel coming to him at Har Chorev, and Eliel comes and stands in front of God, Eliel basically resigns. He says, Kono kineti, I was zealous for you. I tried to do everything I could. I tried to bring your people back to you, and I failed. In our next show, we'll try to understand what is it that God tells Eliel. But Eliel seems to be coming to God, announcing his failure, announcing his resignation. God's going to accept his resignation. He's going to point another V instead of him, Elisha. In our next show, we'll begin to see the contrast between Elisha and Eliel, two very different educational approaches to how to deal with the situation that Jewish people are in. But in today's show, we try to understand, why is it that Eliel stops the rain? And why is it that despite his tremendous miracle, the people don't accept him? We're also going to see in our next Shiurim that Eliel's goals will finally be accomplished. We're finally going to get rid of the Baal. That'll be under the kingdom of Yehu. But it'll take a long historical process. It'll take several decades and many more political events and many more religious events that will finally convince the people of Israel to abandon the culture the Baal brought in. This argument between the people over who's responsible for the rain is reflected in the famous midrash that Chazal bring in the beginning of chapter 17 in Sefer Melachim about the conversation at the Shiva call for Yechiel Beit Ha'eli. Recall that in the end of chapter 16, Yechiel Beit Ha'eli had began to reconstruct the city of Yericho. And when he began that construction, his first son died. At the end of the construction, another son died, just like Yeshua had cursed. And we ask the question, why didn't he understand what's going on? Why didn't he get the message? Probably back then, they thought, what an amazing coincidence. And the conversation between Ahav and Eliel that the Midrash brings down, that Eliel tries to convince Ahav and tell him, look what happened. Look at Yeshua's curse. Yeshua cursed the city of Yericho. And look what happened. Why don't you believe in God? Ahav basically answers, maybe that he believes in curses, but he doesn't believe in God. Because what does he say? He doesn't believe that God's the only God, the all-powerful God. Because what's his answer? He says, who is greater, Yeshua or Moshe? Eliel answers, Moshe. So Ahav says, what about the curse of Moshe? When Moshe said, if you don't follow my laws, I'll stop the rain. And if you do follow my laws, I'll bring the rain. And Achav says, look, we've been serving idols. We've been following Baal Asherah for the last decade or so. And it's been raining. He says, look at my boots. They're full of mud. There's so much rain. There's so much prosperity. So don't tell me that these curses of rabbis and these promises of rabbis work at all. It's all by chance. Don't go prove to me from Chiyo Beit Eli losing two children that I have to listen to what God says in the Bible. And therefore, what was Eliyahu's answer? Chai Hashem, he swears, that he's going to stop the matar for the next 3 years. Achav challenges Eliyahu, and Eliyahu, according to the Midrash, now has a reason to stop the matar.